but getting to the United States is very difficult. Tens of thousands of other Haitians continue to travel through the region seeking refuge. On September 26th, Guatemalan national police agents and immigration officials detained 75 Haitian and Cuban migrants in the eastern part of the country. The migrants were expelled to Honduras. Like many other Haitian migrants, Ernest initially left his homeland in search of jobs in Brazil and Chile. He says, "There is no work in Haiti. How can someone live in Haiti where there is no work?" But he never found the opportunity he needed in Chile, partially due to the difficulty of obtaining legal documents to work. Added to this, the racism against Haitians was constant, he says, so in August, Ernest made the decision to try reaching the United States. He tells The Progressive, "I was only working to eat, and one cannot live like that. Without papers, you cannot do anything." The route to the United States for Haitians is a long one, often starting in Brazil or Chile. In total, it is an estimated 7,000-mile-long trek fraught with dangers such as the Darien Gap, an area with no roads where migrants either walk through the dangerous jungle or travel via water crossing between Colombia and Panama. Despite the risks and the Biden administration's massive expulsion of Haitians at the southern border, Ernest still hopes to reach the United States. He says, "The United States has a better life. I want to be in this country. I do not want to be there illegally, but I want to be there." But Mexican authorities have intensified their efforts to stop migration, and the options for crossing that do exist, including taxis, can cost thousands of dollars. Work in southern Mexico remains extremely limited, despite plans by Mexican President Andrés Manuel López to create jobs in the country's southern states. Following the massive expulsion of Haitians, the United States Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, issued his resignation. In his two-page letter resignation, Foote decried the deportations and the lack of support from the U.S. Department of the State. "I will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees and illegal immigrants to Haiti, a country where American officials are confined to secure compounds because of the danger posed by armed gangs and the control of daily life," Foote wrote in his resignation letter. He added, "Our policy approach to Haiti remains deeply flawed, and my recommendations have been ignored and dismissed when not edited to project a narrative different from my own." Reuters reports that State Department spokesperson Ned Price called Foote's resignation unfortunate before placing the policy failure on the former special envoy, who had only been appointed in July following the assassination of Haiti's president. But the crisis in Haiti following the problematic elections, natural disasters, and a presidential assassination in July is really at its roots, a failure of U.S. foreign policy. Despite the changes in administrations, U.S. policy in Haiti has not changed in decades. The support of democracy has rung hollow, with the United States pushing through their candidates and civil society being largely left behind, as Foote identified in his statement. "The hubris that makes us believe we should pick the winner again is impressive," Foote wrote, adding, "This cycle of international political interventions in Haiti has consistently produced catastrophic results. Migration crisis can be expected to recur as long as the United States keeps supporting, very heavy-handedly, trying to choose who should lead Haiti, these corrupt and undemocratic leaders," Steve Forrester, a lawyer and Haitian immigration advocate with a U.S.-based Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, tells The Progressive. We virtually installed Martelly in 2011. We supported Moa and Foot's resignation letter, as he made clear is about a faith policy that doesn't support civil society, unquote. The situation in Haiti remains dire. Lack of opportunity, crime, poverty, and corruption continue to push migrants to leave. The structural racism all too often continues in South American countries where many have sought a better life. But at the root of the problem is the continuation of a failed U.S. policy in Haiti. And the massive expulsion of thousands of Haitians from the border highlights this failure. Ernest says, it hurts my heart every day. The United States says it is a friend of Haiti, but when it does these things, it makes me think it isn't a friend but an enemy. He adds, the problem of my country is the problem of the United States. The United States only uses the smaller countries. When Haitians cannot live in their country, it is the fault of the United States of America. Ernest pauses, then finally says, it is extremely complicated for Haitians. The subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region, what's going on, who are the key factors involved, what are the people saying, and how are issues changing the future. All of this will be answered with the help of our team of experts and guests. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the revival of Quad and signing of AUKUS military pact. And we will discuss how and why the Assam government in India evicted over 800 Muslim families from a village.
It's September 24, 2021. The Quad Leaders Summit is underway at the White House. Who are in attendance? Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, US President Joe Biden, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, and Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. Later, Prime Minister Modi's office tweets a photograph of the four Quad leaders captioned, "The Quad, a force for global good." But what is the reality behind the story? What does the Quad or Quadrilateral Security Dialogue seek to achieve? The White House statement started off by declaring that it seeks a free and open Indo-Pacific. Many say that the U.S. hegemony is the goal and China is the target.
The Quad, or Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, is a strategic dialogue summit which has been hosting meetings between the U.S., India, Japan and Australia since 2007. For years, the summit was kept under the wraps, but it was not long until the former U.S. President Donald Trump revived the summit in 2017. Since then, U.S. President Biden seems to carry on Trump's legacy. The recent Quad meeting held on September 24, 2021 certainly raised many eyebrows. Although the post-meeting statement released by the White House talked much about response to COVID-19 and infrastructure development, critics remain skeptical, as the statement's punchline was to promote an Indo-Pacific region that is quote-unquote undaunted by coercion. Analysts say China is the obvious target. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian already accused the Quad group of being dedicated to undermining China's interests. After the Quad's virtual summit in March 2021, the Defense Ministry said, the group hangs on to Cold War mentality, pursues group confrontation, is keen on geopolitical gains, and openly incites discord between regional countries. Earlier Quad meetings have come parallel with provocative and hawkish military and naval exercises in the Indo-Pacific region, such as the Malabar naval exercises, which some commentators claim had the potential to start a new Cold War between the US and China. This time, some say that the Western hegemonic powers have taken it too far, as the recent Quad summit comes right after the AUKUS Trilateral Security Pact was announced between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, which aims to help Australia acquire nuclear-powered submarines.
If the Quad wasn't enough, the US has doubled down on its efforts to interfere in a region which is between 12 to 15,000 kilometers away from its land. The US has come into a security partnership with the UK and Australia for, quote, peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific region. It seems that the US has become so paranoid of China's rise to power that the US and the UK not only snubbed their NATO and EU allies, but also led to the scrapping of France's $38.6 billion contract with Australia to build 12 diesel submarines, which has made the European Union feel uneasy.
The US is forming a new Indo-Pacific security alliance with Britain and Australia, whereby the countries will collaborate on military and cyber capabilities, artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, and undersea capabilities, while Australia will also acquire new long-range strike capabilities for its Air Force and Navy and nuclear capabilities for its submarines. The Telegraph, a leading UK news publisher, reported that in March 2021, the Australian Navy Chief met in London with his British counterpart and requested assistance from the UK and the US in acquiring nuclear-powered submarines. Finally, without Macron's knowledge, a trilateral discussion was held between Johnson, Biden, and Morrison at the June 2021 G7 summit in England to finalise the deal. Consequently, Australia decided to cancel the $38.6 billion contract with France, for which it had already spent about $2.4 billion. The move has led to a diplomatic crisis between the US, UK, and France, with the French Foreign Minister calling the move a stab in the back. German Europe Minister Michael Roth even said France's diplomatic crisis with the US was a wake-up call for all of us on the importance of uniting an often divided EU on foreign and security policy. Nevertheless, the agreement to transfer US or UK nuclear submarine technology, including possibly highly enriched uranium, has been described as an act of nuclear proliferation, which is considered illegal according to the international law.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Pepe Escobar, an author and geopolitical analyst. Ms. Escobar, welcome to the program, sir. Now, let's begin by asking about your thoughts on the significance of the AUKUS military pact and why is the US so interested in maintaining influence over the Indo-Pacific region?
Well, first of all, it's not Indo-Pacific. Nobody in Asia, here in Asia, uses the term Indo-Pacific. This is empire speak. The correct denomination is Asia Pacific. And it's been for decades. In fact, this is anyone in from Southeast Asia, where I am, to Central Asia, to East Asia, everybody refers to Asia Pacific. So this new terminology is an imperial invention, basically to make sure that the Quad has some sort of legitimacy. So Indo-Pacific was invented to bring India into what it is already Cold War 2.0 against China conducted by the Empire. And in terms of the Quad, they are allies, Australia, India, and Japan. AUKUS, the new scheme or racket, or pact, or sort of agreement, basically is the Americans telling the Australians, we're going to use you as our springboard, as our forward base in the East, in the Pacific, against China. But this is a very, very long-term project. In fact, there's only one very, very good analysis so far, not by accident, by the Russians, on what does that mean in the long run for Asia Pacific. Basically, the Americans are planning some sort of nuclear conflagration against China for the second half of the 2030s. So this means these are 8 nuclear propelled submarines that are going to be built.
Now in his address to the UN General Assembly, Joe Biden sought to reassure the world that Washington is not seeking a Cold War with China. However, with the recent Quad Summit meeting and the AUKUS bombshell in play, what message do you think this sends to China?
Well, the Quad basically is, for the moment, the Quad is a talk shop. They're going to have one meeting a year, which is not much. But of course, the intel agencies will be in close contact. It's driven by the U.S. It's an exclusive American operation. The other ones are mere vassals, of course. And the importance of Australia, it's because it's part of the Anglo Club, of course. Britain is not part of the Quad. India is part of the Quad, but India and Japan are treated as minor players, even though they haven't noticed that yet. So this is an Anglo Club operation. Australia is being instrumentalized by this American obsession. So basically, it's the Anglo Club, but controlled, once again, controlled by the U.S., but Australia now launched into a very, very dangerous position. And obviously, the Chinese will have plenty of time to not only understand the consequences, but to prepare about what might happen in the second half of the 2030s.
Mr. Escobar, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on the Quad Summit and the signing of the AUKUS military pact.
Carlos Martinez, an anti-war activist, says the world eagerly awaits an end to military escalation against China, dismantling of AUKUS, NATO and the Quad, and end of illegal sanctions against countries like Iran. Lawyer and writer Akshay Chudasama says formation of the AUKUS and the Quad makes it clear that USA wants to curb China's growing involvement in global affairs. Kerry Collison, an international author, shares an Asia Times article that says the new big power security architecture exacerbates the divisions within ASEAN regarding the US-China struggle for dominance. Author and academic Happyman Jacob says if AUKUS overshadows the enthusiasm around the Quad, it would be disadvantageous to India's interest in the Indo-Pacific.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
On Monday, September 20th, 2021, 800 Muslim families, which consisted of around 5,000 individuals, including women, children, and the elderly, were kicked out of their homes in the Darang district of the Assam province in India. 4 Muslim religious sites were demolished and 2 people were killed, while several others, including police officers, were injured. Different groups have cited different reasons for the evictions. BJP government leaders claimed that these people were illegal Bengali immigrants who were encroaching on government land. Many local news channels and BBC Bangla claimed that the eviction drives were also being conducted to restore a prehistoric Hindu temple, while some human rights and minority groups have termed it communal politics driven by prejudice against Muslims.
A mass eviction campaign is underway in the Indian province of Assam. According to Assam Chief Minister Himanta Biswa Sarma, 800 families have been evicted and four religious structures have also been destroyed as a part of a drive against illegal encroachments. According to the Indian non-profit news website The Wire, the actual figure could be 900 and number of affected could be up to 20,000 people. The figures worry some people more than others because most of the affectees are Muslims. The BJP government leaders claim that the people being evicted are illegal immigrants from Bangladesh, but there is confusion as to how these affectees have been deemed so, seeing that origins of many rural settlements and settlers are unclear. The answer? A highly controversial citizens list, the National Register of Citizens. The NRC made almost 2 million residents of Assam province stateless and led to massive waves of deadly protests in India because it was seen as prejudiced against Muslims. Accordingly, protests have now erupted after reports of violence have emerged since the eviction drive started. Indian Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi claimed that Assam is on state-sponsored fire after two people were killed and at least 20 people were injured by open firing and live use of ammunition by the police. Social media witnessed shocking videos of police using violence and open firing against people protesting the forced evictions. There was even a video showing a man kicking an apparently dead person with a bullet wound on his chest and jumping over his body.
Not too long ago in 2019, the government in India was considering legalizing illegal settlements in Delhi, which would include some 700,000 households in unauthorized settlements in the city. Now the question is, why are these people in Assam being treated differently? Even if we agree to claim that the evicted people in Assam are illegal settlers, and even if we forget about giving proper rights to these people, there is another question to ponder over. Where will these people live? How will they get the basic necessities to live and survive? And most importantly, do these people really deserve this?
Despite having evicted 800 families and having cleared 602.40 hectares, the Assam Chief Minister claims that the eviction drives will not stop. The government has provided no rehabilitation plan to deal with the suffrage of the evicted people who live without water, shelter, or food. Assam Pradesh Congress President Bhupen Kumar has raised concerns about the coronavirus pandemic and the vulnerability these people have been placed in. India is one of the world's worst affected countries when it comes to the COVID-19, and around 500,000 people have so far died in the country. Kumar also claimed that the Supreme Court had also given a directive against eviction during the pandemic situation. Yet the state government, led by Sarma, has been behaving in an autocratic manner to evict the residents of Dholpur, who have been living in the area since the 1970s. Hate and violence against the Bengali Muslims of Assam are not new. Harrowing screams of women and children being massacred during the Neli massacre of 1983 can still be heard. 38 years ago in the same province, over 2,000 people were massacred during a span of 6 hours. What is the cause of division till this day? Some say divisive politics. Former BJP President Amit Shah referred to illegal Bengali immigrants as termites, and the rhetoric has been similar across the party leadership. The current Assam Chief Minister earlier fought and won the BJP's second stint in power in Assam by framing it as a contest between 65% Hindus and 35% Muslims.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Shoaib Daniel, a journalist based in New Delhi. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Daniel. Sir, almost 5,000 people, including children and elderly persons, have been forced to live under the open sky in Assam's Darang district. Could you elaborate more on the dire situation in Darang?
So this is basically an issue in the northeastern state of Assam in India. And this is an extremely old issue in which Bengali Muslims, which are Muslims of who speak the language Bengali, are often victimized in the state of Assam. They are often branded as Bangladeshi immigrants, which is the country to the east of India. Although very often these accusations are incorrect and driven more by xenophobia than any fact. So this is another continuation of that, where Muslims, Bengali Muslims, who are being evicted from land that the government claims is not theirs. So this is yet another iteration. We've had many iterations of this conflict coming into fore recently. A couple of years back, we had something called the National Register of Citizens, which was very unique in the world, where every citizen of Assam, as long as they were, you know, they weren't quote unquote indigenous, was checked for their citizenship. So this is the way it's a sort of a mix between communal politics, which looks at the division between Hindus and Muslims, but also there is a ethnic mix.
Mr. Daniel, from what I know, two people have died and several others have been injured so far. Now, why is the BJP-led government going to the extent of using violence against these people, and what is there to achieve?
So so we'll have to just quickly go into the recent politics to understand that there's a new chief minister in Assam. His name is Himanta Biswa Sarma. And he's really stepped up this process from what he calls evictions. So in this case, he's using extreme violence as well as very publicized violence, you know, in a very sort of jingoist and very aggressive manner to try and evict what he calls squatters on land. So, I mean, there is actually no need to use this violence, but yet this provides, it's a beneficial politics for this chief minister as well as the party that he belongs to, which is the ruling BJP, which is Mr. Modi's party. So I think that's why he's doing it, because it provides, there is a strong, unfortunately, there is a strong, there is a strong market in Assam politics for this sort of aggression against Bengali Muslims. So hence he's doing that.
Mr. Daniel, two Muslim mosques and one religious school were also demolished. Now, could you say this encroachment drive is part of a larger campaign to disenfranchise Muslims?
I would actually, while there is of course growing, you know, there's growing Islamophobia in India, and there are growing, as you know, many people have pointed out, there is a shrinking democratic space in India, with Muslims being at the receiving end in many cases. This incident is actually, I mean, while there is an India repercussion, in which case that it's the BJP that is in Assam, and a lot of their politics feeds into Assam. But this is also a very local and old conflict, where Bengali Muslims who are an ethnic minority in the state of Assam, although they're a minority which is very large, they're one third of Assam, but still they are very poor, so they're getting attacked. So while there is, I mean, so I would answer that question in yes and no. While there is an all India while there's an all-India umbrella under which this is happening, the virulence of this and the scale of violence that was used is very much a product of this state's politics, and might not necessarily, at least in the near term, map to other parts of India, at least in its scale.
Mr. Daniel, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on the recent mass evictions of Muslim families in Assam's Darang district.
Independent journalist Sakshi Yoshi says most TV channels in India didn't give space to Moinul because the incident took place in BJP-ruled Assam state and the victim was a Muslim. Gaurav Gogoi, a Congress parliamentarian, slams India Today Media Group for irresponsible reporting on people being evicted in Assam. He says it is neither factual and nor based on draft NRC list. Politician and activist Abdul Majid terms the eviction of Muslims and police firing in Assam as outrageous and says the police act was highly outrageous, inhumane and brutal. Mahmoodul Hassan, a multimedia journalist, quotes victim's brother as saying that the police killed his brother after a brutal assault while demanding justice for his slain brother. Prominent journalist and TV anchor Gargi Rawat shares an article that debunks the false theory that those killed in police firing in Assam were illegal Rohingyas.
And that was our episode on India, Quad, an AUKUS military pact, and the mass evictions of Muslim families in India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Migrants' rights advocates have recently accused President Joe Biden of embracing his predecessor's racist policies and endangering families, following a court ruling that will allow the administration to continue expelling asylum seekers under the pretext of protecting public health during the COVID-19 pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Advocates Blast Biden for Embracing Trump's Racist Policy as Court Upholds Title 42 Expulsions. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Migrant rights advocates has recently accused President Joe Biden of embracing his predecessor's racist policies and endangering families following a court ruling that will allow the administration to continue expelling asylum seekers under the pretext of protecting public health during the COVID-19 pandemic. Recently, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit ruled in Hiusha versus Mayorkas that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, DHS, can continue removing asylum-seeking migrants under Title 42, a section of the Public Health Safety Act first invoked by the Trump administration as the coronavirus pandemic began in March 2020. Title 42 was scheduled to be lifted in compliance with the lower court's order. However, the Biden administration, which has deported hundreds of thousands of migrants under the law, appealed the decision. human rights experts, including United Nations officials, have condemned Title 42 removals, which plaintiffs' attorneys in Hiusha called a pretext to deport migrants legally seeking asylum in the United States. Expert scientists at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention rejected the use of public health powers to expel non-citizens as unnecessary, a court filing in the case asserts. But the process was nevertheless imposed on the CDC by White House officials seeking to limit immigration and not as a bona fide measure to protect public health. ACLU attorney Lee Glarant, the lead lawyer in the Title 42 challenge, said following the ruling that if the Biden administration really wants to treat asylum seekers humanly, it should end this lawless policy now and withdraw its appeal. He vowed, "We will continue fighting to end this illegal policy." Tommy Goodlett, director of litigation at the Refugee and Immigration Center for Education and Legal Services, RAICES, and co-counsel in Hiusha said in a statement that the Biden administration should never have appealed this case. Goodlett said the lower court concluded Title 42 was illegal and should not be applied to exclude families from seeking asylum in the U.S., but rather than allow families to seek refuge in the country, which is legal under U.S. law and international law, the administration chose to further promulgate the Trump administration's racist and xenophobic policies by appealing the case and then proceeded to expel thousands of Haitians from Del Rio, Texas under Title 42. The Biden administration has lost its way and needs to remember its promises from the election, Goodlett added. Migrants deserve better. The country deserves better. Nila Chakratula, managing attorney at Center for Gender and Refugees Studies, CGRS, and another co-counsel in the case said, the Biden administration embraced the Title 42 has exposed people seeking safety to untold violence and suffering. The administration's decision to defend the policy in court is unconscionable and a complete betrayal of the president's promise to restore access to asylum, asserted Chakratula. Recent events have laid bare the tragic consequences of Title 42. In less than 2 weeks, the administration has expelled over 5,000 Haitians to a country plagued with widespread violence and insecurity, a human rights travesty, and no small operational feat. They could have used those resources to safely welcome Haitians seeking refuge, he added. Instead, the president has adopted Trump's racist policy as his own, without regard for the families and children harmed as a result. Amy Fisher, America's advocacy director at Amnesty International USA, said that once again, the Biden administration has shown that it is more committed to defending Title 42 than upholding the human rights of asylum seekers. The continued weaponization of the pandemic to expel people from the border will result in serious harm for thousands who have been denied protection, including thousands of Haitians who have been brutalized and expelled under the policy in recent weeks, Fisher added. There is simply no way around it. Title 42 must end, and every day the Biden administration fights to uphold it, they choose xenophobia and racism over protecting human rights. Carla Marisol Vargas, senior attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project and Hiusha co-counsel, said in a statement that by fighting to keep Title 42 in place, this administration is doubling down on its commitment to continue the racist and violent policies of the Trump administration and to further entrench cruelty and racism into an immigration system in sore need of change. A system that continually violates the basic human rights of migrants, especially black and brown migrants. The violence against black migrants in Del Rio showed us not only this administration's utter lack of humanity, but it also showed us the absolute lack of will in upholding the promises it claimed when on the campaign trail, she added. The recent ruling came hours after DHS issued new guidance for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and other agencies prioritizing the expulsion of people in the country illegally who are a threat to national security, public safety, and border security. While DHS says the guidance is meant to empower authorities to exercise greater discretion and weigh the totality of the facts and circumstances when considering deportations, Maralena Hincape, executive director of the National Immigration Law Center, warned that the memo places a dangerous amount of discretion in the hands of ICE agents. Economic divide.
The fall of the U.S. dollar is happening, 1 cent at a time. While there's a decline in the U.S. standing as a superpower, there's also the harsh reality that the U.S. is facing, the decline of the U.S. dollar. Hi, I'm Kavit Hathley. In this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at whether the fall of the U.S. dollar is hyped or whether it is really happening, like a slow death for the U.S. Coming up in today's program, the share of the U.S. dollar in reserves held by central banks has fallen to its lowest level. What does that mean? Is that a move away from the dollar? That is a key question that we'll be looking at in this program. Another one of the highlights is how U.S. debt is playing a role in the decline of the dollar. There's a sovereign debt crisis that the U.S. is experiencing. Is that a reason for the dollar to collapse? We will examine the ways that that may be happening. And finally, we will take a look at something that the U.S. is using called dollar weaponization. The key instrument, sanctions, and the countries that are at the receiving end of it, at least some of them, are Iran, Russia, and China. Stay tuned.
The dollar is king. That is the saying.
Well, the dollar is very strong. The country is very strong. The dollar is it's a beautiful thing in one way, but it makes it harder to compete. And despite that, but we have a very powerful dollar.
But it has been losing its value for quite some time. This new worry, COVID-19, investors are worried the U.S. response is dealing a blow to the dollar, its status as the world's reserve currency, declining.
With the recent gold price rally, and fueled by the ongoing and growing socioeconomic issues, the USD's position as the world's reserve currency might be threatened.
Investors and analysts, including billionaire hedge fund manager Ray Dalio and Goldman Sachs Group strategist, warning that massive U.S. government spending in recent months could hurt the U.S. dollar. At the same time, rock-bottom U.S. interest rates for the foreseeable future and concerns over potential rise in inflation are denting the dollar's appeal.
What we've seen this go-around is the need to distribute, to produce a lot of debt. Where did those checks come from? They came from the government. The government wrote the checks. But the government can't produce money. The central bank can produce money.
These factors are already weighing in on the dollar, which stands 9% below its high of the year and had its worst monthly performance in a decade for the month of July.
When there has to be a lot of selling of bonds, and bonds don't give any good return, there's a guaranteed negative return in bonds relative to inflation. And there's a pile of people who own bonds. And this isn't just Americans, but these are international investors owning bonds. And they have to buy a lot more bonds, because when the government has to sell a lot more debt, that means they have to buy a lot more bonds, there will not be enough demand for those bonds.
There's also the real issue about the economic policies of major governments of the world. The declining value of the U.S. dollar has come about because the investment community sees the U.S. government following a more expansive economic program than the other major governments.
It's a critical market. Let's face it, China's the world's second largest economy. It's one of the fastest growing major economies today. We've all seen some of the economic challenges of the world over the last 2 years with COVID and some of the struggles to recover from that. China was kind of first in and first out, and so has done recovered very quickly.
The U.S. dollar has been declining in value for quite some time. The key question is why? Also, we keep hearing about the fall of the dollar as the top currency of choice, but actual numbers prove otherwise. First, the fall. That is true. Since March 2020, its decline has moved steadily after the U.S. presidential elections. Note here the peak in the dollar index in this graph. It came on March 19, 2020. In the middle of July, July 15 to be exact, the WSJ dollar index was 90.57. Just before the election that happened on November 3, the index stood at 88.25. Then the decline in the value of the U.S. dollar picked up steam. Why did the U.S. start losing its value due to Biden's election win? Well, because the U.S. President Biden at this point has taken a more aggressive stance with respect to the economy. Just take a look at this $6 trillion budget plan. Now, this was proposed in May, which did not get fully approved, included the following: a $1.5 trillion request for operating expenditures for the Pentagon and other government departments. It also incorporated two plans that he had previously publicized: a $2.3 trillion jobs plan and a $1.8 trillion family plan. That's quite a lot, isn't it? And we're also going to cover how that affects the standing of the dollar. Well, joining us in the studio is our guest, Ahmad Salehi. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us. He is an economic analyst, and he has a specialty in the management of industrial projects. And this is his Twitter address, @AhmadSalehi _MEY May, and also he is active on Instagram. Ahmad.Salehi _official is his address on Instagram. So welcome. Obviously, our topic is the dollar, and my key question here is a general one: why the U.S. dollar is used as a reserve currency. It's most often used in trade, given the fact that there are other currencies, and it still is the reserve currency of choice. I mean, the whole international financial system seems to be structured around the U.S. dollar. What's the reason? I mean, does the U.S. have a monopoly over it?
My pleasure to be here.
Sure.
Actually, the whole thing is a matter of trust and a plain check that the world gave the United States in Bretton Woods. But what was the underlying foundation that gave the United States this power was the old cult myth that wars are good for the economy of the United States. You have to carefully study the history of the First and Second World War. Actually, when the world was in a war during both the world wars, the United States was providing the world with goods and material, but it was not getting currency, but gold in compensation. So, during these two world wars, two-thirds of the gold reserves of the central banks was accumulated in Federal Reserve. So, this was the first common foundation that gave the authority of the United States in Bretton Woods to actually dominate its dollar.
Okay. Let's fast forward then. Thank you for that history check on that. Hopefully that answers a lot of questions regarding the dollar back then and its beginning. But we're going to take a look at two different vantage points in the way that the dollar is being covered. First, we're going to take a look at this graph. It says the IMF's new data shows that the share of the U.S. dollar reserves held by central banks fell to 59%. That is the lowest level in 25 years. And that happened during the fourth quarter of 2020. Mm-hmm. So it's very recent, pretty recent, actually. So that's one way that the dollar is being covered. Then you have this falling cliff and its take on how the dollar is doing right now.
Even as the coronavirus pandemic wreaked havoc across global markets, wiping out trillions of dollars worth of assets, the U.S. dollar was unaffected by the turmoil. At one point, it soared 4% against a basket of major currencies, namely the euro, pound, yen, Canadian dollar, Swiss franc, and Swedish krona.
So on the one hand, you have that in terms of the reserves falling to its lowest level in 25 years, and then you have what it said here, that during the pandemic, the dollar actually rose, and it actually gained strength against the other currencies in the basket.
Yes. Actually, we have to take a look at it from a wider span. There are reasons that the empire of dollar is dominant in the world. We can simplify it into four pillars. The first pillar is the trade of the energy, mainly oil in the world, which is purely done by dollar. The second pillar is the IMF and the World Bank as the regulators of the fiscal and monetary policies throughout the world. And the third pillar is the WTO, which is the main function of WTO is spreading and increasing and promoting the global trade. And we know that the global trade is done via dollar. And the last, actually, pillar is the reserves, the currency reserves of the central banks. So if you want to have a better look at what is going on and what will be the future, we have to study carefully these four pillars. Of course, there are some internal factors also inside the United States economy. We're talking about the socio-economical parameters like the demographic of the population, the age of the population, which is getting older and older. But regardless of the internal factors of United States economy, when we look at these four pillars, we see that all of them are changing, not with a very rapid speed, but with a steady one.
We're going to have you back a little later on in the program, but for now, thank you very much for that, Ahmed Saleh. I do appreciate your comments, obviously very insightful there. So you heard some of the explanation that was given there by Ahmed Salehi. Our next piece is going to take a look at the U.S. dollar, but in terms of the debt that it has accumulated, how that plays into the picture. And obviously with that comes the printing of the greenback, as you're about to find out.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. We are going to take a look at the U.S. dollar and why it's called a petrodollar. You may have heard the term, and how that is actually under threat. Now, the petrodollar, by definition, is any U.S. dollar that's paid to oil-exporting countries in exchange for oil. The dollar, as you know, is the preeminent global currency. That's how it's been. As a result, most international transactions, including oil, are priced in petrodollars. Now, oil exporting nations actually receive dollars for their exports, but not in their own currency. Now, the question comes about in terms of how oil is pegged to the dollar and not to another currency. I mean, that's a viable question. Now, why that is, it's due to a 1945 U.S.-Saudi agreement, which created the petrodollar. That's when it was born. What benefits comes from that, the petrodollar, for the U.S., that is? Well, it provides three immediate benefits: increasing global demand for U.S. dollars, increasing global demand for U.S. debt securities, and it also gives the U.S. this ability to buy oil with a currency that it can print at will. Think about that. That's a very important advantage that this brings for the United States. Now, most oil exporting nations, such as Saudi Arabia and Iraq, for example, own their oil industries, and since they receive their payments in dollars, that makes their national income dependent on the dollar's value. So that means if the dollar falls, so does their government's revenue. Now, since they don't want to lose their payments value, most of these oil exporters have pegged their currencies to the dollar. And what does that do? Well, if the dollar value falls, so does the price of all of their domestic goods and services. Now, that helps these countries avoid wide swings in either inflation or deflation. Now, let's take a look at this question, how the dollar can actually be threatened. Well, just think about how oil is pegged to the dollar. All economies are oil-based. Pretty much a lot of things you see around you have some connection to oil in one way or another. So if there was a shift from oil to other renewable energy sources, that could threaten the petrodollar. So hopefully that makes sense to you. I mean, if you take a look at it, on the one hand, you have what's happening, the switch to renewable green energy, which threatens the dollar. And the other hand, you have countries which the dollar is shunned since it is being weaponized against them by the U.S. That's another point that needs to be considered here. Well, to explain this a little bit more for us, David Barkman, he's a professor of economics at the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana from Mexico, who joins us. He was a founding member of the Eco Development Center in 1974, for which he was awarded the National Prize in Political Economy. David, welcome. The dollar as a reserve currency falling out of favor with a number of countries like Russia, China, Iran, Pakistan, Nigeria, to name a few. Now, these countries have been on the receiving end of sanctions due to political fallouts that they've had with the U.S. What are the pros and cons in dumping a dollar in their bilateral trade?
Well, I think that the expression you use, dumping the dollar, is unfortunately not very relevant for many of those countries, because they're doing trade with international corporations, with private parties that are demanding payment in dollars for these transactions.
David Barkman there, and of course he made a great distinction. However, next up is going to be a report on how the U.S. actually uses the dollar as a weapon, the countries involved, but more so the focus being the process that it goes through in order to enforce its what's called sanctions business.
The U.S. is weaponizing the dollar to keep its global standing. It is convinced of an existential threat from competitors. It does this to maintain its global economic and geopolitical position. Others disagree with U.S.'s approach. The U.S. accounts for about 20% of the world's economic output, and more than half of all global currency reserves and trade is in dollars. This was the result of the 1944 Bretton Woods agreements, when each member agreed to redeem its currency for U.S. dollars, not gold.
So let me start with the debt cycle. You know, in 1945, we began a new world order. 1944, we created a new monetary system, the Bretton Woods monetary system. And then we created that new world order. And that created a bull markets in stocks and an American world order for the most part. There's a cycle.